Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Audience. Pope Benedict reflects on how we should live and be transformed by the new life brought to us through Christ's resurrection. Karol Wojtyła, the man. What was Pope John Paul really like as a person? George Weigel, his biographer and friend, shares with us his insights into the character of the man who will be beatified this weekend. All things blessed. Leading Catholic commentator John Allen gives his take on the upcoming beatification of Pope John Paul. And whispers from a blogger. In the run-up to next week's first ever Vatican meeting with bloggers from around the world, we find out more about what makes a blogger tick from one of the foremost Catholic bloggers in the US. At his Wednesday General Audience, Pope Benedict reflected on how we should live and be transformed by the new life brought to us through Christ's resurrection from the dead at Easter. Chris Altieri reports.
The joy of the Easter season was the focus of Pope Benedict XVI's reflections during his weekly General Audience on Wednesday in St. Peter's Square.
Dear brothers and sisters, in these first days of Easter, the Church rejoices in Christ's resurrection from the dead, which has brought new life to us and to our world.
The Holy Father noted that St. Paul exhorts us to make this new life evident by putting to death the things of this earth and setting our hearts on the things that are on high, where Christ is seated at the right hand of the Father.
Having put on Christ in baptism, we are called to be renewed daily in the virtues which he taught us, especially charity, which binds all the rest together in perfect harmony. By living this new life, we are not only interiorly transformed, but we also change the world around us. Charity, in fact, brings its spiritual freedom, which can break down any wall and build a new world of solidarity, goodness, and respect for the dignity of all.
Easter, continued the Holy Father, is a gift to be received ever anew in faith, so that we may become a constant leaven of life, justice, and reconciliation in our world.
As believers in the risen Lord, this is our mission, to awaken hope in place of despair, joy in place of sadness, and life in place of death. With Christ, through him and in him, let us strive to make all things new.
After his catechesis, the Holy Father had greetings for pilgrims in many languages, including English.
I welcome the newly ordained deacons of the Pontifical Irish College, together with their families and friends. Dear young deacons, in fulfilling the ministry you have received, may you proclaim the gospel above all by the holiness of your lives and your joyful service to God's people in your native land. Upon all the English-speaking pilgrims present at today's audience, and work an abundance of joy and peace in the risen Lord. Happy Easter!
I'm Chris Altieri.
Young men and women, you are the future of the world, and the day of tomorrow belongs to you.
As the beatification of Pope John Paul II draws ever closer, people around the world are using this occasion to re-examine the life, achievements, and legacy of this towering figure on the world stage during the final part of the 20th century. Karol Wojtyła was a figure who brought so many new aspects to the papacy. The first pope from Poland, the most travelled pope ever, the first pope to visit a mosque and a synagogue, and the pontiff who created more saints than any other pope, and who now is about to be placed on the penultimate step towards sainthood himself. But what was Pope John Paul like as a person, as a man? One American who became a personal friend of the late pope was George Weigel, Catholic scholar and author of two biographies on John Paul. Weigel met the Polish Pope dozens of times before and during the research for his books, and shares with us his insights into the character of Karol Wojtyła, the man. What was the most striking aspects of his personality, something that perhaps was not immediately apparent to the outside world, but that you became aware of as you got to know him during these meetings?
I would say three things that I was unaware of going into the project of writing the Pope's biography. One was the enormous influence of his father in his life. I think his father, who was also named Karol Wojtyła, was the single most important figure in the first 20 years of his life. Secondly, the formative experience that the Second World War was for him. This was a crucible moment in which this personality was formed, the commitment to human dignity and human rights was honed and sharpened, and the commitment to serve those causes through the priesthood of the Catholic Church was made. In terms of qualities or characteristics, I would say he was the most relentlessly curious man I have ever met. He was always wanting to know what was going on. What were the books? What were the movies? What were the arguments? What were the articles? What was going on in the worlds that I touched that he couldn't touch directly? In other words, this is a man who was constantly looking ahead. There was nothing nostalgic about his personality at all. And I came to understand that curiosity not so much as a psychological tick of some sort, but as a reflection of his deep Christian faith. He really believed that Providence was at work in history, and therefore he wanted to know what was going on, because that allowed him insights into how the divine will was working itself out in perhaps surprising ways at this moment in time.
And did he ever laugh or joke with you? And if so, what about?
Oh, yes. He had a very robust sense of humor that tended towards the ironic, but it was not irony in the kind of cynical sense of irony. It was irony in the sense of, oh, wow, look at what the Holy Spirit has done now in a surprising way. He once, as I report in the book, The End and the Beginning, invited a Polish actor who was in Rome to town. And in the course of the conversation, he asked him what role this man was playing in a very famous Polish play called Forefather's Eve. And the actor, a man named Jerzy Sztor, said, "Your Holiness, I regret to report that I am Satan," who is a character in the play. And the Pope thought about this a minute and said, "Well, none of us gets to choose our roles, do we?"
Good one. Yes. How Polish was he in his outlook, his friends, his habits?
I think he was a great Polish patriot who understood that much of his personal formation, intellectual formation, came out of the richness of 1,000 years of Polish culture and history. I would say the most strikingly Polish thing about him, though, was not what he ate on holidays, or that Polish sisters cooked for him, or that he loved to sing Polish Christmas carols to the 15th verse with his old friends over the telephone back to Poland. It was his way of looking at history. Poland, the state, disappeared from the map of Europe for 123 years. Poland, the nation, survived that through its culture. And that taught him that the most dynamic force in human affairs over the long haul is not politics, it's not economics, it's culture. And that gave him the capacity to bend history in a different way by revitalizing cultures, for at the heart of culture is religion, what we cherish, honor, and worship. And that, I think, was his theory of historical change.
Do you think he was, in some ways, quite a solitary man? I mean, we learned how he would spend a long time, you know, in prayer by himself, sometimes prostrate on the floor.
I wouldn't say solitary. I would say that this was a man of genuine mystical gifts who would withdraw into a space where he was not alone, but he was in communication with God in a way that he could not describe. I am often asked, can I describe this mystical experience of his? To which the obvious answer is, I can't describe it because he couldn't describe it. This was a conversation that took place beyond words, before words. It perhaps comes through most clearly in his poetry. I think his poetry was a way he could process, if you will, these experiences in a non-linear, non-discursive way. But ultimately, there is always going to be, at the heart of the person of John Paul II, as in the heart of any great mystical figure, a mystery. And we shouldn't be surprised at that.
Did he ever express disappointment about something or something, some achievement that he wasn't able to accomplish or that he would have done differently if he could have lived his life over again?
The one issue that he pressed me on after Witness to Hope was published was, will it be published in Chinese? I think he very badly wanted to go to China, knew that that was not going to happen, and thought of my book as a way of bringing him to China in a way that he couldn't manage physically. And I'm happy to say that shortly after the beatification, the book will be ready in Chinese, thanks to some great help from Cardinal Joseph Zen. I think that it was a deep disappointment to him that he could not go to Russia. No pope in history had a greater appreciation for the spirituality and theology of Russian Orthodoxy than John Paul II. And yet he was met with everything ranging from discourtesy to hostility on the part of the leaders of Russian Orthodoxy. And I think that that was a wound. He was obviously deeply hurt by the revelation that priests had betrayed their vocations around the world, particularly in the United States and Ireland and elsewhere in Europe. And that was a suffering for him. I think he was, frankly, disappointed that Constantinople and Rome were not together again at the end of the second millennium, as he might have imagined they could have been when he came to the papacy in 1978. And, of course, he was a fierce and vigorous defender of the right to life, and I think was saddened by the degree to which a culture of death, as he called it, in 1995, was seeping throughout the Western world.
I was speaking to George Weigel, biographer and friend of Pope John Paul.
Non abbiate paura, aprite, anzi spalancate le porte a Cristo.
Allen works for the National Catholic Reporter in the US and is one of the world's leading commentators on Catholic affairs. He's among the thousands of journalists who have come to Rome to cover the beatification ceremony for Pope John Paul. So how would he describe this event, and what message is this beatification sending to the Church and the world?
Well, at one level, a beatification obviously always offers the same message, that this person lived a holy life, in the technical language, a life of heroic virtue, and is now in heaven with God, capable of interceding in requests for prayer. And that is true of John Paul II, as it is of all the other beati, blesseds, that have been proclaimed by the Church. But, I mean, at another level, obviously, this beatification is a massive celebration of the life and legacy of one of the most stunningly successful and wildly popular popes of all time. You know, this is a pope who took over the Catholic Church at a moment of sort of doubt and confusion, what a lot of people perceived as drift for the Church, and he gave it a massive sort of infusion of energy. I mean, he was almost like Jolt Cola for the soul. And I think the excitement that he stirred in the Church around the world is, in a sense, symbolized and captured and re-expressed by this beatification.
And how much interest is there among the American public at large in this event?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to remember that John Paul remains massively popular in the United States. There's a new Marist College poll out which finds that 74% of the American public and a stunning 90% of American Catholics believe that John Paul is a worthy candidate for beatification. Now, if you know anything at all about American Catholics, you know that it's hard to get 90% of them to agree on what day of the week it is. The fact that 90% of them would therefore agree that John Paul deserves the honor that's being bestowed upon him in this beatification is nothing short of a kind of a minor miracle. I mean, you could almost argue that's the next miracle for the canonization. And so he remains a pope whose memory and whose influence is very much alive. And that is generating, I think, significant media interest in the United States. All of the major American networks have their A-list reporters and pundits on the ground in Rome to cover the event. It will be closely watched and closely commented upon.
We know what he was like as a pope, and we've been talking lots in these last weeks about his accomplishments, his legacy. But what about him as a man? How would you describe his personality?
Well, I think John Paul II was one of those almost once-in-a-generation guys who had this kind of animal charisma that just dominated any room he was ever in. A wicked sense of humor. Absolutely fearless, willing to say anything to anyone at any time. Marvelous command of gestures and in facial expressions and so forth. I mean, he could communicate more with a withering look or a smile than most of us can in 1,800 word news analyses. I think that explains part of the appeal of John Paul. I mean, clearly part of it was the message. Part of it was the deep faith and the palpable sense of holiness he inspired. But part of it too was even people who didn't share any of that, didn't share his philosophical convictions, didn't share his spiritual beliefs, nevertheless just liked the guy. I mean, they saw in him what people would describe as a mensch, a real authentic human being, someone who was comfortable in his own skin, who knew what he stood for, but was also interested in where you were coming from. And I think at that human level, that was a kind of universal appeal that was part of the magic of his papacy.
Now, you've been covering the Vatican for many years. Do you have any vivid recollection of one or more anecdote concerning Pope John Paul, maybe some especially memorable remark that he made to you or in your presence that you can share with us?
Well, I'll give you two. One that's me, and then one's an insight into John Paul. The one that's me is I started covering the Vatican in the late 90s, and of course, by that point, John Paul's twilight, in a sense, had already begun. He wasn't quite as communicative as he once was. The first time I had an opportunity to meet him in person was on a papal trip in 2001. We were going to Kazakhstan, and this was 9 days after 9/11, so there's a lot of media interest in that trip and what John Paul would have to say. So it had been a very exhausting trip. At the end of it, those of us who were new had the opportunity to come down and sit next to the Pope in Shepherd One, the papal plane, and have a few moments with him. Now, by that stage in my career, you have to understand that I had probably written several million words about the Pope. I had talked about him for hours on television. I mean, in theory, if someone was going to be capable of coming up with something intelligent to say to him in that moment, you would think it would be me. And yet when I was plunked down in that chair next to him, the sort of awesomeness of the moment sort of overcame me. And the only thing, honest to God, the only thing I could croak out was, "Holy Father, it's nice to meet you." I mean, the most banal thing imaginable. And he could tell that I was struggling to come up with something more intelligent to say. And he reached out to me and patted me on the arm and said, "It's okay." And then went on to give me a couple of thoughts about what the trip had meant that I didn't even ask. But had I been able to formulate intelligent questions, these would have been great answers. I mean, in other words, he understood. I mean, he'd been in those situations often enough to know that, even people who aren't supposed to be intimidated by him nevertheless were. And he broke that ice on his own. It was a marvelous, not only was it a great sort of communication strategy on his part, it was a marvelous pastoral act. Other story is this. I remember when John Paul went to Greece, which he also did in 2001, I had been asked by Greek national television to do an interview with them. And the question to which the whole interview built was, is John Paul going to apologize for centuries of mistreatment of the Orthodox? And I said, well, look, here's the thing. I mean, John Paul has apologized for many things over the course of the years. He has, in fact, in the past, apologized for mistreatment of the Orthodox. But normally, those apologies are very carefully prepared theologically and we haven't gotten any hints of that in this trip. So I think my concluding line was that if anybody is coming to this trip expecting an apology, they're likely to be disappointed. They played that interview on Greek national television as the lead-in to the meeting between John Paul and Archbishop Christodoulos, the Patriarch of Athens and all Greece. So literally 5 minutes before the Pope and Christodoulos sat down, there was me saying there's not going to be an apology. And of course, 15 minutes later, John Paul delivered precisely the apology I had just predicted that he was not going to utter. Classic example of how John Paul was, among many other things, a pope of surprises. Just when you thought you had him figured out, when you knew whether he was going to zig or zag, he would pull the wool over your eyes.
I was speaking to John Allen of the National Catholic Reporter, and who's also Vatican analyst for CNN. Those wishing to download on their phones Vatican Radio's programming and practical information updates during the beatification of Pope John Paul this coming weekend should go to the following link: http://rv.va/5. They are housewives, students, priests, journalists, and many other professions as well. But they all have one thing in common. They're Catholic bloggers who will be attending the first ever meeting for bloggers in the Vatican, organized jointly by the Pontifical Councils for Culture and Social Communications. The meeting on May the 2nd will be attended by 150 bloggers from around the world. The Vatican says the aim of this gathering is to allow for a dialogue between bloggers and church representatives, to listen to the experiences of those who are actively involved in this field, and to achieve a greater understanding of the needs of that community. One of the best-known Catholic bloggers in the English-speaking world is Rocco Palmo, who set up his daily blog in 2004 with a readership of just 3 people. The blog title, Whispers in the Loggia, refers to the tradition of cardinals and bishops whispering about the latest church news through the loggia, or open-aired hallways attached to Italian churches. Palmo's blog covers the latest news from the Vatican and the church around the world, and now gets more than 25,000 visitors every day. He will be one of the bloggers attending the May 2nd meeting, and I asked him whether he was personally surprised by the Vatican's decision to convene this gathering.
Well, I'm surprised because it's been called so quickly, but also because of the speed with which the Holy See has really seemingly come to recognize the importance of the blogosphere in the life of the wider church.
And how valuable do you think this meeting will be? I mean, obviously you're going to have a chance to meet face-to-face with so many other bloggers and find out where blogging is going, but tell us more what you think will come out of it.
Well, several of the people who are going to be part of the meeting are already good friends of mine, people I've known and worked with and know face-to-face, which is important, for a long time. But the importance here, I think, is more of a kind of the Holy See doing something that only it could do, bringing people together from different language groups, different ideologies, different concepts of the church, and really bringing us together into a unity, not just amongst ourselves, but also how the Holy See, how the wider the institutional church could help us do what we do, but also how we could further advance the mission of the church in what we do.
Right. Tell us a little bit about how you got involved in blogging. First of all, what gave you the idea for the name Whispers in the Loggia?
To be honest with you, Susie, it was a complete thunderclap, something that popped up in my head because there was actually a moment where somebody whispered something to me in a loggia here in Philadelphia that ended up panning out. And so I thought to myself, this is how things become news in the church. And I was attracted to it because I was 8-9 months out of university, knew I wanted to cover the church. But even at that time, traditional media here in the States was just falling apart. And there was no place to kind of end up. So I thought, well, this gives me the chance to do news on the church in my own way. I gave the address to a couple friends, and like wildfire, it spread. I mean, it spoke to a hunger I had no idea existed. I knew it just existed for me.
So you started in 2004. How many people did you have sort of coming to your site then, and how many hits are you getting now on average?
I gave the address to three friends, and now it's getting around 25 to 30,000 visitors a day, around 45,000 hits a day. The counter is at 17 million visits, I think, since mid-2005. So I don't like to think about that, though, because the more I think about it, the more it freaks me out.
What does it take to be a successful blogger? What are the characteristics you need to have, the skills?
I think it's like any vocation. You have to be yourself, you have to be human, especially in terms of, you know, writing on the church. You have to love the church. You have to love people. You have to be Christian. And, you know, you have to really have heart for what's going on. You can't just see things through the prism of your own biases, your own ideologies, your own ways of wanting the church to be what you want it to be, but what God wants it to be. And that's what lifts the work up, but it also lifts God's people up and brings people who may not agree with you together. Because any work that's going to succeed has to be bigger than yourself, has to be bigger than the writer. Like any vocation is bigger than the person who's said yes to it, but it gives life to the whole.
You are described as having keen insights into the events unfolding from the Vatican. Now, how quick are you with this news? Have you had some scoops?
I think I've broken before at the OVC some 50 appointments here in the States. We've got another one coming in the morning, and the first of which was the appointment of Cardinal LeVay to the CDF. So as betting averages go, that's not bad.
Now then, no journalist, of course, reveals his sources, but you must obviously have some pretty good sources. Can you give us a few clues, a few peeks?
That's under the seal of the confessional, the journalist.
Do we have any idea at all how many Catholic blogs there are out there in the blogosphere?
There are something like 10,000, I think, that as of last measurement. But you have to remember, one thing about the blogosphere is no blog is exclusively Catholic. It may address the world from a Catholic perspective, but it may talk about, you know, architecture, music, politics, news. It's very interchangeable. Among the well-read ones, there are maybe 20 or 25 just in the English-speaking world. But how the blogosphere has grown in terms of even beyond America and Britain, which are the kind of base of it, into India or even, you know, the other language groups are going to be present. Still a work in progress. But that's actually spiritually, it's a good analogy because we're all spiritually a work in progress, and I know I am. It's a way of recognizing in this Easter season the presence of the Holy Spirit in the church, new ways of communicating. This is his gift to us. And the fact that this meeting's happening is the Holy See's way, I feel, of recognizing this new, unexpected, sometimes unpredictable charism. And having done this work for all this time, you can't be more humbled by that.
Okay, turning to the future, where do you think blogs are going? Do you think the number of blogs is going to increase? Are they going to change in their format? How do you see the future panning out?
Well, I mean, again, I began mine for news. Others began theirs for spiritual reflection, for venting, for any number of reasons. But the cycle is increasing rapidly. You know, what John Paul II talked about in 2005, you know, Rapido sviluppo, the rapid development, is still increasing. I mean, I could sit on the story for 10 or 12 hours back when I started this, you know, and think about it and kind of come up with more ideas on it. These days, between Twitter, blogs, Facebook, I mean, I can't sit on things that long. You know, the processing time has increased markedly. So as for the future, you know, I hope, I mean, from a Catholic perspective, that things become less visceral, that we realize that we're speaking in terms of the 2,000-year tradition, and sometimes we need to just kind of step back and breathe.
I was speaking to Rocco Palmo, Catholic blogger based in Philadelphia. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.